This is the takeaway for Thursday, December 14th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. December 14th, 5 years ago.
And it is just coming across the wires here, reading straight from it. Connecticut State Police responding to reports of a shooting, we're told.
The images you see here, children being led from Sandy Hook Elementary School. One shooter is dead.
They're reporting multiple fatalities involved in the shooting at the elementary school.
Their mother, Nancy Lanza, was found dead in the house.
At that residence here in Newtown.
Reports say the number of dead closer to 30 than to 20. And sadly, most of them are children.
It was late in the morning on December 14th, 2012, that the nation first learned of a shooting. 700 students were inside the halls of Sandy Hook Elementary School, located in western Connecticut, in a town called Newtown. 20-year-old Adam Lanza arrived at the school after killing his mother using her guns. At about 9:30, he shot his way through the elementary school entrance and launched a shooting spree. Lanza then fired 154 rounds in less than 5 minutes. He killed 20 children on that day. Six adults were killed as well. The school's principal and a school psychologist were the first to respond and became Adam Lanza's first victims.
Dawn Hochsprung, 47 years old. Strong, confident, inspiring, and compassionate, she was always willing to fight for what she believed in.
Mary Sherlock, 56 years old. A dedicated school psychologist with a mission to provide mental health services to children and teens.
We don't identify all the dead when we report on disasters. Today, we are. Thanks in part to a special memorial website set up by victims' families. Because what happened at Sandy Hook shocked Americans' conscience in a way it had never been shocked before.
Jesse McCord Lewis, 6 years old. He was a remarkable child, full of light and love that radiated in his presence. He brought joy to the world.
Catherine Hubbard, 6 years old. Gentle and kind, she loved all animals and had a special connection with them.
Grace Audrey McDonald, 7 years old. Beautiful, kind, and loving, she was full of life, imagination, and sparkle. Grace was an artist. She saw beauty in everything.
Jack Armistead Pinto, 6 years old. Jack was a happy, inquisitive, and energetic boy.
Caroline Prebity, 6 years old. Bright-eyed and cheerful, an energetic young girl who cared deeply for others.
The majority of those who died today were children. Beautiful little kids between the ages of 5 and 10 years old. They had their entire lives ahead of them. Birthdays, graduations, weddings, kids of their own. Among the fallen were also teachers, men and women who devoted their lives to helping our children fulfill their dreams. So our hearts are broken today for the parents and grandparents, sisters and brothers of these little children, and for the families of the adults who were lost. Our hearts are broken for the parents of the survivors as well. For as blessed as they are to have their children home tonight, they know that their children's innocence has been torn away from them too early, and there are no words that will ease their pain.
Adam Lanza ended the killing by turning a gun on himself. The entire rampage lasted less than 11 minutes. The country then sat in horror as photos of victims, young, smiling children, were spread across television screens and their names were announced on radio broadcasts.
Josephine Gay, 7 years old. She had a way with people, a way without words. She spoke with her eyes, her gentle hugs, her sweet spirit, and her little hands.
James Radley Mattioli, 6 years old. He loved school, his friends, and being outside. He had boundless energy, love, happiness, and curiosity.
Charlotte Helen Bacon, 6 years old. She loved having her hair tied in piggies with ribbons, pink frilly dresses, and animals, big and small.
Noah Posner, 6 years old. He was energy in motion. His zest for life was contagious. He was endlessly inquisitive, always wanting to know the why and how of things.
Victoria Lee Soto, 27 years old. Her zest for life was evident to all who knew her. She was serious if she needed to be, and silly more often than people would expect. She was beautiful, with sparkling blue eyes.
Benjamin Andrew Wheeler, 6 years old. The constant sparkle in his eye showed his delight with all the world and his slightly mischievous plans for it.
In the aftermath of the shooting, an emotional President Obama called for action. He told lawmakers and the American people now was the time to respond.
Can we truly say, as a nation, that we're meeting our obligations? Can we honestly say that we're doing enough to keep our children, all of them, safe from harm? Can we claim as a nation that we're all together there, letting them know that they're loved and teaching them to love in return? Can we say that we're truly doing enough to give all the children of this country the chance they deserve to live out their lives in happiness and with purpose? I've been reflecting on this the last few days, and if we're honest with ourselves, the answer is no. We're not doing enough. And we will have to change.
A month later in Connecticut, Governor Daniel Malloy spoke before the state legislature and asked lawmakers how they would respond.
We have lifted one another up and continued carrying the spirit of our fallen heroes and our wounded families and our beautiful lost children. As a state and as a community, we will continue to do whatever we can for the families of Newtown. But we must also ask ourselves, what is our responsibility? To those we've lost, to one another, to the children, and to future generations.
Daniel Malloy announced the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, the goal to guide future action on mental health, on gun violence, and on public safety.
Now, we may never know what motivated the events at Sandy Hook Elementary, but that will not stop us from working to prevent future tragedies. Over the coming months, the commission will come together to make specific, actionable recommendations in areas of school safety, mental health services, and gun violence protection.
Other states followed Malloy's lead. New York joined Connecticut and banned the possession of semi-automatic weapons and large-capacity magazines. Dozens of states tightened their gun laws in similar ways. Schools across the country installed metal detectors and revamped lockdown protocols, determined to protect their kids. Some guests on this show have advocated arming more teachers and even parents and training them to intervene in the case of an active shooter.
If something happens, they can step in and they can actually save lives. They don't have to be another Sandy Hook.
Victims of Sandy Hook refused to remain silent. The families of 9 children killed that day filed a wrongful death suit against the manufacturers and distributors of the Bushmaster rifles Adam Lanza used and against the store that sold the gun he used in the shooting. A teacher who survived the attack also joined that suit.
Now, Remington may never have known Adam Lanza, but they had been courting him for years. And the courtship between Remington and Adam Lanza is at the heart of this case.
That lawsuit still sits in the courts today. It was allowed to proceed in 2016, then dismissed in October of that year by a Connecticut Superior Court judge. The families appealed and are now awaiting a decision by the Connecticut Supreme Court. And while Connecticut suffered, much of the rest of the country moved on. Lawmakers in Congress introduced dozens of gun safety amendments and bills. Many were minor. Nothing passed. The Senate came close to expanding background checks to include all commercial gun sales. 4 months after Sandy Hook, that bill failed.
Lauren Gabriel Russo, 30 years old. Lauren was a sensitive and focused young woman. As a child, she played school and always kept her desire to become a professional educator as she grew.
Chase Michael Anthony Kowalski, 7 years old. He was a fun-loving, energetic boy who had a true love of life. He could often be found in the yard playing ball, riding his bike or quad.
Jessica Adrian Ricos, 6 years old.
She was an independent, smart, and creative little girl who was always eager to learn new things.
Emily Parker, 6 years old. She was an exceptional artist who expressed her creativity, love, excitement, and her true self through art.
Daniel Barden, 7 years old. He was a child who would hold the door open for strangers, scoop up his tiny aunt friends to reunite them with their families, and befriend the classmate who always sat alone.
Aviel Rose Richmond, 6 years old. Rarely without a giant grin, and was often barefoot. Like her parents, she loved stories and demanded them as she was falling asleep.
By the end of his second term in the White House, President Obama would call his visit to Newtown 2 days after the December 14th shooting, the worst day in office in his 8 years as president. There have been hundreds of mass shootings in this country since the Sandy Hook massacre. They've become almost normal. And so is the response, the ritual, thoughts and prayers, demands for action, and then very little to help prevent them from ever happening again. 58 people were killed this past October when a gunman opened fire on concertgoers in Las Vegas. More than 2 months later, we still have no answers, no motive, and no reason why. In November, a gunman opened fire on a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. 26 people, again, many of them children, were killed that day. One family who lost 9 family members filed a federal claim against the U.S. Air Force for not following protocol designed to prevent the shooter from having a gun. And so in the absence of action, today, we remember what happened on December 14th, 2012, at Sandy Hook Elementary.
Allison Wyatt, 6 years old. She formed special bonds with most people who spent any amount of time with her.
Olivia Rose Engel, 6 years old. On any given afternoon, one could just as easily find her twirling in a pink tutu in dance class, developing her swing on the tennis court, or honing her inner songstress in her community musical theater class.
Dylan Christopher Hockley, 6 years old. His smile, his laugh, his love of bouncing on trampolines and eating chocolate, his deep empathy in reacting to the feelings of others.
Madeline Shu, 6 years old. A beautiful, joyful daughter, a petite princess with a big personality. Life for her was a dance and a race.
Anna Grace Marcus Green, 6 years old. She instituted the house rule of seconds. Her favorite seconds included second breakfast, second dessert, and second hugs. And she could outgroove just about anyone.
Rachel DeVino, 29 years old. She had an unrelenting determination and a clear focus on helping adults and children with autism. Rachel's best friend and soon-to-be fiancé, Tony, were to be engaged on Christmas Eve. He had just asked her parents' permission to marry her.
Anne Marie Murphy, 52 years old. Anne was a special education aide at Sandy Hook Elementary School, a mother of 4, and a caretaker until the end.
We mentioned that special website Sandy Hook family members set up to remember their loved ones. You can visit it, too, at mysandyhookfamily.org. This is The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
The digital world bears no resemblance to a water pipe or electric line or sewer. The use of those pipes will be roughly constant over time, and very few would say that there's dramatic innovation in those areas. By contrast, online traffic is exploding, and if our rules deter the massive infrastructure investment that we need, eventually we'll pay the price in terms of less innovation.
That's Federal Communications Commission Chair Ajit Pai you're hearing there, as the FCC voted to roll back net neutrality today. Those rules were created by the Obama administration in 2015. They classified the internet as a public utility and prevented internet service providers from restricting or slowing access to certain websites. Other countries have already made some moves away from net neutrality and experienced some of the future that might be in store for us here in America, like charging more for certain apps or simply blocking websites altogether. April Glazer covers technology for Slate.
So the rules will actually go into effect probably around the end of January. And when that happens, you're not likely to see this immediate thing where, you know, some websites load super fast and some websites load super slow. Instead, what you might see are certain types of preferential treatment given depending on the internet service provider you have. So imagine AT&T, for instance, you know, giving free access to HBO if you're an AT&T subscriber. And if you're an HBO fan, then maybe you'd be more likely to subscribe to AT&T. If you're a Verizon subscriber, let's say, you know, you could get Spotify for free, or maybe access to Facebook would be a lot faster if you use Verizon as opposed to using Comcast. And it's going to be more like these little preferential treatment that is given to some websites over others that might not seem like, you know, huge violations, and you might even like at first, but overall will lead to a much more tiered internet where some websites are just, you know, way preferred than others, and that's going to make it a lot harder to reach the smaller websites or for smaller websites to even have a chance at being successful.
Now, you just described two different things, though. Having a service like HBO for free, like I could save on the subscription for HBO Go if I signed up for, I don't know, T-Mobile or something like that. That would be great. But then you said other websites might be slower. Those are two different things. I wouldn't mind getting access to Netflix for free, but if Amazon were slower, that'd be different.
That's right. So let's say you're a big Amazon user and Amazon strikes some kind of deal where they pay Verizon to have really fast access to Verizon customers. Then you're going to be more likely to subscribe to Verizon and you'll get faster access to Amazon. The thing with the new rules is that ISPs can essentially do whatever they want as long as they let subscribers know that they're going to be doing whatever they want. Like, they only have to say, we reserve the right to slow down access to some websites or charge websites a fee to access you faster. And so we might start to see just very different types of internet depending on who you're getting your internet from, as opposed to this kind of level playing field that we have right now.
So after today's vote and the vision for American internet in the future, is there a country out there that closely mirrors what the United States internet scape might become?
Not closely, and that's because we don't actually know what is going to happen in the U.S. because the new rules are pretty much a free-for-all, right? Like I said, the ISPs will essentially be able to do whatever they want as long as they let you know that they're going to be doing whatever they want. But we do have some examples where in countries it is allowed for carriers to give preferential access to some websites over others, and we usually see that over mobile. Under the current laws, the U.S. could become like China, where, you know, if a certain ISP wants, they could just say, we're going to block freely, and then they block freely. And, you know, if you only have access to one broadband provider in your neighborhood or in your area, that broadband provider does decide to block access to certain websites, then you're just out of luck.
Now, you're talking about blocking access to websites for commercial reasons, not necessarily ideological censorship, but the result might be the same. Are we really likely to see that?
That's going to be unlikely because it's going to inspire a huge outrage in the American public. And that's because people won't have a choice but to use the internet provider that is, you know, doing such nefarious censorship. But, you know, what we are likely to see, though, which does happen in other countries and is actually legal now in the United States, but we're probably likely to see it happen in a much more pronounced and escalated way, are things like mobile providers offering free access to certain apps. Representative Ro Khanna tweeted a picture of what an internet mobile plan in Portugal looks like. And that's because in the EU, they do have net neutrality rules, but they don't have rules against a process called zero rating, which allows like a mobile provider or your cell phone internet provider to not charge you to access certain websites. So you buy the internet there for your phone, you can add an additional packet that says once your internet is expired, you also get free access to, you know, Spotify or iTunes or Apple Music or something like that. You know, or you, let's say you buy the streaming package and after your internet is used up, you still get access to Netflix. That's not a neutral practice, and we might start to see a lot more of that. That means that those telecom companies are essentially deciding who gets to be in that bundle of, you know, apps that you only have access to and who doesn't. And that's basically going to entrench the power of those already popular apps.
So April, if big companies are going to carve up the internet into a series of apps like you predict, doesn't it also mean that somebody's going to come along and have, I don't know, FreedomNet? They're going to market the fact that they have unfettered, full freedom access to the internet, and I can just buy that?
You know, it would be great if consumers could vote with their wallet in that case, right? So let's say they don't like the fact that AT&T is, speeding up access to Facebook or speeding up access to certain news websites and therefore slowing down access to other websites. That doesn't mean that they can go somewhere else and find a, faster internet connection. And that's because the access to broadband in the U.S. is usually limited, and for most people, to one or two options max. There's just not a plurality of choices when it comes to who you get your fast access from. And that's from a long history of just consolidation and limited access to who gets to lay fiber in the United States. And so we see these large companies kind of controlling the pipes entirely. If there was a more plural market and if there were more companies that were allowed to provide fast internet access to people across the country, then maybe the market would be able to kind of regulate itself a little better, and we wouldn't have to depend on the FCC to stop ISPs from discriminating against certain websites. But right now, we just don't have that kind of economic environment.
April Glazer, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
April Glazer writes about technology for Slate.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
I accept this appointment, and it will be my great honor to serve Minnesota as United States Senator.
Less than a week after Democratic Senator Al Franken said he's leaving the Senate because of sexual misconduct allegations, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton has found a replacement. You just heard there from Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, who's been picked to take the seat once Al Franken steps down.
Though I never anticipated this moment, I am resolved to do everything that I can to move Minnesota forward, and I will be a fierce advocate.
Tina Smith is a Democrat. She also says she will run in the 2018 special election to serve out the final 2 years of Al Franken's term. This will make Minnesota one of four states with two female senators. Hey, here's trivia. Can you name the other three? Hit me on Twitter if you think you know, and super bonus points for naming those senators. No Googling. Let's go back to Minnesota, though. Brian Baxt is Capitol correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, Brian.
Hello there.
Well, Brian, who is Tina Smith, the woman who is soon to be the next senator from Minnesota?
She's the consummate behind-the-scenes player. She spent decades in Minnesota politics, mostly working on behalf of other people, former Vice President Walter Mondale, Governor Mark Dayton, Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback. She burst onto the scene and political scene herself in 2014 when she ran as lieutenant governor with Mark Dayton, and that's the only elected office she's ever served.
And now that she's being pushed to the fore, what do people expect from her?
They expect a steady hand. You know, she's one of these people who's not showy. She likes to collaborate with people. She's very respected within the business community, and she's seen as kind of a deal maker. But she's also got very strong Democratic principles. So there's an expectation that she'll vote with the Democrats on most, if not everything.
Chuck Schumer can expect no real trouble from her.
No. And in fact, she shouldn't really be all that out front on a lot of things. And it's different for her because now she's running for the seat as well in 2018. So she's going to have to do a little bit to elevate her profile. She's not that widely known in Minnesota, despite her political office.
So, Brian, Al Franken still hasn't said exactly when he's going to step down from his Senate seat and resign. This special election will take place in 2018. Now, a lot of people guessed that Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minneapolis and deputy chair of the DNC, would run for a Senate seat. But he says he supports Tina Smith.
That was a big surprise yesterday. Within moments of the press conference ending where Tina Smith was introduced, Keith Ellison put out a statement saying he throws his full support behind Tina Smith, and he took himself out of consideration. Keith Ellison has been building his profile. He's deputy chair of the DNC. So getting him on board was a big deal.
Talk about how many Republicans or even other Democrats might be waiting in the wings to challenge Tina Smith after her short incumbency in 2018.
You saw a lot of Democratic groups and other Democrats rallying behind Tina Smith, so she might have a, a field clearing effect on her side. There probably will be kind of one or two other people, but it's still a big question as to whether anyone with stature will step up to challenge her. On the Republican side, this is a rare opportunity, an open seat. So we're hearing a lot of names of people, you know, state senators. Former Governor Tim Pawlenty is at least considering it. He hasn't ruled it out yet. There's a bunch of people who could run. And of course, there are people who want to see maybe an outsider come into this, somebody who doesn't have a long political record to tear apart.
But Brian, doesn't Governor Mark Dayton's decision here also set up a bit of a weird situation in the governor's office? The person who takes over for Tina Smith as lieutenant governor is a Republican who's going to be working for a Democrat.
Absolutely. And there's already quite a bit of conflict around that. The state senator, Michelle Fischbach, says that she wants to do the lieutenant governor job and keep her state Senate job. The Senate is divided by a single vote at this point with Republicans. And if she left, who knows who would fill that seat? So Democrats could potentially take over the majority of the Senate if there's a special election, given this climate, even though it's a fairly Republican seat in most years. And so this thing seems like it's headed to court. The governor has already requested an attorney general's opinion, and the state Senate has already issued its kind of legal primer that says, we think she can hold both jobs.
Brian Baxt, Capitol correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
You're welcome.
By the way, your trivia, the other three states with two female senators, California, of course, Washington State, and most recently, New Hampshire. Open enrollment for people to sign up for the Affordable Care Act's Federal Exchange ends on Friday. Here to talk about what you need to know, Mary Agnes Carey, partnership editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, despite the slings and arrows that Obamacare has suffered in Congress and survived, open enrollment is still going on. How's it done this year?
As of new figures that were released yesterday by the federal government, as of December the 9th, 4.5 million people had signed up for insurance on the federal marketplace. And we need to remember that represents about 39 states. And of that number, just over 1 million plans for the most recent week, which was December the 3rd through the 9th. So that's about 650,000 ahead of the same week last year. New enrollment's up about 17%. Overall for the year. But as you note, open enrollment ends on Friday, which is the 15th. And usually it was open till the end of January. So the thought is we won't have as many people enroll in the Affordable Care Act as in previous years because you've had that enrollment period cut off 6 weeks earlier.
Why has it been cut off by 6 weeks?
Well, there was a decision made by the Trump administration to do that. The thought was eventually as the Affordable Care Act continued, as we know, enrollment began in 2014, that over time, the enrollment period would be scaled back to make it shorter than January 31st, but the Trump administration decided to do that a little bit earlier. So not only did they shrink the enrollment period, but we have to remember money for advertising and outreach was cut 90%. Money for the on-the-ground assisters, the navigators, the people that sit with you and help you, the federal funding for that was cut by an average of 40%. So when you add all those up together, it's really taken quite a hit on open enrollment.
It's taken quite a hit, and yet it's far ahead of the pace than previous years. It sounds like signups are beyond a level that Barack Obama could only have dreamed of when he was trying to drum up enrollment.
And we do have to see what happens through Friday. As we know, people like deadlines. It's not just the reporters. A lot of people will be motivated when they realize, if they realize, we've got to sign up by December 15th. I need to get to healthcare.gov. I've got to call the 800 number. So we really are going to be watching over the next couple of days to see, is there a big uptick, especially for younger folks? They tend to wait till the very end to enroll.
Yeah, so here comes the deadline. What do you have to know and what do you have to do if you're up against it here? You have to go on the website, you said.
I think it's very important. If you are currently on the Affordable Care Act and you have not gone to healthcare.gov to look at other options you might have, that's something that you should do. Because if you're in a plan and its price went up and you don't make a choice to leave that plan, you're going to be auto-enrolled. So that's very, very important for you to know. If you are going to look at health insurance for the first time on healthcare.gov, whether it's a federal exchange or your state-based exchange, depending on where you live, you need to think about what's the coverage I need, can I get financial assistance, and you need to think about what doctors do I need in my network, which hospitals, what kind of labs, what sort of services are my prescriptions covered? You need to think through those things as you pick a plan.
Mary Agnes, what's going on in the tax bill that's being negotiated in Congress right now? That bill looks like it's going to be done in the next few days. There's a repeal of the individual mandate in there. What does that mean for people?
There's going to be a repeal, it looks like, to your point, if this bill passes in its current form, that would repeal the individual mandate penalty. And again, that's the requirement that most of us have health insurance or pay a fine. Many analysts have said if you remove the individual mandate, that requirement to have insurance, you may have many people, especially healthy people, decide, I can't afford this. I don't need to enroll in it. Yes, I won't have health insurance, but I won't have to pay the penalty. And so what we call the risk pool, that combination of people that are covered by a particular policy, a particular plan, may be packed with sicker people who are more expensive. So the premiums continue to climb because the insurers have to take care of sicker people. So the real concern is this will drive away healthier people who tend to be younger. But again, as we've both seen now for years since the Affordable Care Act became law, Republicans have tried to repeal the law. They failed to do that. This is viewed as a strike to the heart of the Affordable Care Act to weaken it.
Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act on the federal exchange ends tomorrow. Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Always great to have you, Mary Agnes.
Thanks again for having me.
The Affordable Care Act has managed to survive another enrollment period. Meanwhile, if you look north of the border, though, they don't have any of these types of fights. No exchanges, no repeal, no. Canada has found stability with universal health care. We've been spending the last week looking at why American health care looks the way it does. Could we have taken another path? The answer takes us back to 1962, when Canadian-style healthcare was born. The United States was also considering expanding healthcare at the time. Both political fights were vicious, but only one country ended up with universal coverage. WNYC's Mary Harris explains.
Before I take you to the birthplace of Canadian healthcare, which is Saskatchewan, I need to take you someplace else.
From Madison Square Garden in New York City, ABC News presents an address by the President of the United States.
We're in New York City, 1962, and there's an overflow crowd waiting to watch President John F. Kennedy speak.
The President is now entering the garden as the crowd applauds.
He's about to make his best pitch for Medicare. That's health care for seniors. All three networks carried this speech. And what's funny if you listen to it now is how the arguments he makes more than 50 years ago sound just like the arguments you'll hear about healthcare today.
This is a campaign to help people meet their responsibilities.
He talks a lot about how seniors deserve this help. They've worked for it.
The fact of the matter is that what we are now talking about doing, most of the countries of Europe did years ago.
Back then, Canada had already done a version of this too. President Kennedy's plan wasn't actually complete medical coverage. This original version of Medicare didn't cover drugs or doctor visits. It was just 60 days of hospital care.
Take note, 60 days of hospital care.
That's it?
That's it.
I asked Ted Marmer to explain this moment to me. In the 1960s, he was on Capitol Hill trying to get this Medicare package passed.
So I want to make sure I understand this right. So the debate in Washington in the 60s, it sounds like, was really just about this really basic hospital care.
Absolutely, but the doctors were scared to death that it was first step.
The first step towards socialized health care, government control. Doctors were so alarmed that a group in New Jersey threatened to go on strike if Kennedy's law passed. And the reason those physicians were so certain that nationalized medicine was just around the corner here in the U.S. is because of what was happening at the very same time in Saskatchewan.
Headed by the leadership of Tommy Douglas, who, by the way, was recently selected by Canadians as the most popular Canadian in its history. That tells you something.
I think that medical care is so important that it ought not to have a price tag on it.
Tommy Douglas was a former Baptist minister, a socialist, and he was beloved. His plan was called Medicare II, but it was much more expansive. It wasn't just hospital care, and it wasn't just for old people. It was access to a doctor for everyone.
Everything will be exactly the same as it is now, except one simple thing. That is that instead of the doctor sending the bill to you, he will send the bill to the medical care plan. Now, surely there's nothing very complicated about this.
By the time John F. Kennedy was making his speech in Madison Square Garden, Tommy Douglas's Medicare plan was set to go into effect in a matter of weeks. And here's the thing.
Canadians were no more egalitarian than Americans were in the 1950s and 60s. Good gracious. Do not think that Canadians were Ruskies in, you know, in fur coats.
Just like those doctors in New Jersey, the doctors of Saskatchewan, nearly 1,000 of them, were getting ready to go on strike. Some were ending appointments by telling their patients, after July 1st, I won't be able to see you anymore. It was alarming.
I have a family of 5 little girls. One girl is suffering from cerebral palsy. Now you tell me, sir, when this specialist leaves...
Canadians like this man rallied the government to delay the law. But they lost.
Where will I go? Tell
me. But, sir, this is not the issue.
This is the issue. This is my issue. This is the people's issue.
When the new law went into effect, Saskatchewan's doctors closed their doors.
Today, the lines are firmly drawn. The government is putting Medicare to work, and the doctors are putting their emergency service into operation.
The physicians' main concern was how much they'd be paid.
Negotiation has failed, and today it's come to a physical test of strength. The doctors have locked their office doors and say that from now on, they will treat only emergencies.
But doctors were worried about government control, too. They talked about a future where doctors were like slaves and menopausal women were sent to mental institutions.
What's important about that strike is how vicious the fight was.
The strike lasted 3 weeks. Even after it ended, some Canadians weren't convinced that government health insurance was such a great idea.
Personally, I'm not too happy about it. I'm rather disappointed in the doctors. Myself, I'm a medical student, you see, and I hope they'd fight it to the end, and I was kind of hoping the government backed down.
But within a decade, universal health care had spread to all of Canada's provinces. Meanwhile, in the United States, that health care bill President Kennedy was fighting so hard for, hospital coverage, just for the elderly, it didn't pass. Here in the U.S., organized resistance by doctors seemed to work.
Men and women of America, I appeal to your sense of fairness.
2 days after his big speech in Madison Square Garden, the president of the American Medical Association took to the same stage and made a rebuttal.
If our government wants to move toward welfare state medicine, let them tell us so honestly.
The AMA paid nearly $100,000 for the venue and more for time on 190 television stations so Americans could watch.
I implore you, ask your doctor. Ask your doctor. Thank you.
So I asked Ted Marmer, why was Canada able to fight off the same kind of opposition from doctors and pass something so comprehensive?
Reformers believed that in American politics, you needed to expand by groups that didn't raise the ancient issues of deservingness.
So they sliced off sections of people, one at a time, people they decided were worthy of health care. And after a few years, they did pass Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the very poor.
Which allowed them to say from then on, what do we need? People get insurance at work. They get Medicaid if they're poor. And they get hospital and medical care if they're over 65. And eventually, we can probably cover the disabled.
Ted Marmer does have one regret. Not encouraging his bosses to include children in the list of people who deserved Medicare or Medicaid back then. It wasn't until 1997 that Congress passed CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. And they only did that after President Clinton's larger healthcare reform effort failed, a story we'll explore tomorrow. For The Takeaway, I'm Mary Harris.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor for WNYC's Health Desk. To hear more from our special series, head over to the website at thetakeaway.org/healthcare.
Support for America's new credentials on The Takeaway is funded in part by the Joyce Foundation.
Wherever we live, whoever we are, we all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
French President Emmanuel Macron there with a message after the United States withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. And President Macron wasn't just goading Americans led by President Trump there. This week, Macron granted 18 climate scientists long-term research grants to carry out their work In France, they're actually called Make the Planet Great Again grants, and 13 of them went to U.S.-based scientists. But thousands of researchers applied, and that's not a big surprise, because a steady lack of funding for climate science over several administrations means fewer permanent research jobs, and now other countries like France are looking to take advantage. Our new credentials series looks at the future of work and education along with the Joyce Foundation. So we talked to Switzerland-based journalist Sean Mowbray, who's written about what he calls the climate science brain drain from the environmental news site Mongabay. I asked Sean, what does this brain drain look like?
Well, it's really manifesting itself in a few different ways. There's the simple aspect of scientists leaving or looking to leave the United States and pursue opportunities abroad. But then there's also what could be called an in-house brain drain, as particularly young scientists are pursuing different careers as money becomes tighter, or they're looking to move into the private sector due to a lack of federal jobs or funding.
So somebody who wants to stick in climate science and is finding it tough in the United States might go and study in Europe or get a grant in Europe and do their work elsewhere. Or if they're young enough, might just abandon the field altogether and apply their skills in some other field.
Exactly. That's kind of the situation that we're looking at the moment, with funding being tight as it is and potentially getting tighter with the cuts that are proposed by the Trump administration.
But you say this problem didn't start with the Trump administration by any means.
Yeah, of course, it's easy to point the finger at Trump, but Obama's record on science funding was also sketchy. That wasn't through lack of trying. But in fact, there's a study from 2013, which is quite interesting. It looked at 3,700 scientists, not all in the field of climate science, but around 20% of those people questioned were saying they were thinking of leaving the US at that time to continue their research or look for jobs. And that was in 2013.
And Sean, how important is federal research funding to the whole field of climate science? I mean, if federal research funding goes down 8%, does it get made up elsewhere, or is that really, really mission critical?
The federal funding in the US is definitely critical. It's the lion's share of funding for science and for climate science. I don't think that this funding would be able to be made up by private funding or other sources. I think it would definitely be critical for the field.
Well, I want to bring in Tripti Bhattacharya. Tripti is a postdoctoral climate scientist at the University of Arizona who is pursuing work both in the United States and outside the U.S. right now. Tripti, is that right?
That's correct.
And so at the point, Dr. Bhattacharya, that you're at in your career right now looking for postdoctoral fellowships or postdoctoral work, what's the funding situation for you and how is it affecting your ability to advance your research?
Personally, I was lucky enough to help write a grant that got funded by the NSF, so I'm set for about 2 years. But across the board, I've heard about cuts to postdoctoral fellowship programs and funding agencies. Cuts to, for instance, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration resulted in cuts to a really well-known postdoctoral fellowship program. So funding is getting tighter across the board, and it's making it harder to find positions.
And can you tell me a little bit about your work? What is it that you do?
So I study tropical rainfall variability and monsoon systems, and I study past instances of climate change in the geologic record to understand the mechanisms that govern rainfall variability.
And let's just be clear, in the data that you're compiling now, do you see irrefutable evidence of climate change?
Yeah, that's a running thread through most climate scientists' work.
So as you're trying to compile these data, trying to do your research, money's getting tighter. Talk about your day-to-day life, just the practicalities of considering, at least, having to go elsewhere to continue.
So on a daily basis, I don't think the funding situation's affecting what I do. So I still work in lab, I still write papers. There's definitely a lot more pressure, though, to start writing grants really early in your career. So I put in a grant this year. And in terms of applying for permanent jobs as faculty, we're seeing a tighter situation in the United States. So that led me to consider jobs in Canada and the UK as alternatives.
And we should just point out, Tripti, you're talking about writing grants earlier in your career. When you're in academic research like you, it's not always a question of applying for a job, interviewing for a job, getting hired for a job. Sure, that's part of it. But you've got to have the conduit of research money that you can either obtain or bring with you for a department to want to take you on.
Exactly, especially for postdocs. So in many cases, a faculty member may want to hire you, but can't because there isn't the revenue stream or the funding to do so. So you might spend 2 or 3 years trying to get a grant together and get it funded that supports your position.
So there's a bottom line factor here that means real jobs.
Exactly.
So before I let you go, let me ask each of you on the effects on the science for this brain drain. Sean, you know, it's pretty clear the United States might miss out on the type of research that Tripti's doing if the Tripti's of the world leave. But it's one planet, and, you know, you might say, well, if the research has to be done in France or in Germany or in the UK or somewhere else, at least it'll get done.
Yeah, I think that for the field of climate science in general, there are countries out there who are acknowledging that climate science is important, and that can only be an incredibly positive thing.
Tripti, how does the United States lose out, do you think, in terms of the quality of the science that we produce, or really just solutions to the problems that you're researching, if people like you go to Canada or the UK, like you may wind up doing?
So I want to emphasize that not everyone is mobile. Getting used to a new academic culture and funding agencies in other countries is difficult. And there's also a personal cost to uprooting your life. The other issue is that the United States has long been a leader in science in general, but especially climate science, with some of the top modeling groups and some of the top scientists being in this country. And I think we really miss out on the social benefits of that research if we stop funding climate science. And those include an improved ability to predict extreme events like droughts and floods, like we've seen in the past year, and understanding the future of our natural resources. So really, if we want to keep the country strong, so to speak, we need to be investing in basic science.
Tripti Bhattacharya, climate researcher at the University of Arizona. Dr. Bhattacharya, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Sean Mowbray with the environmental news site Mongabay. Sean, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
My name's Julie, and I work at University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. So we talk about leaving the United States for better research conditions all the time. With the deteriorating quality of life for scientists in this country, the rise of anti-intellectualism, continuously decreasing funding for students, universities, and research, failure to appoint scientists to scientific government positions, and the increasing animosity to scientists of any stripe, a lot of us talk about going somewhere else.
Researchers, we want to hear from you on this. Are you like Julie there in Denver at the University of Colorado? Would you consider being part of the brain drain and going overseas to do your research or find a better job? Tell us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. In the meantime, thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.